here we go. We can start tonight with the Lavush. His known, his real name is Mordechai Yaffa. He lived from 1535 to 1612. He learned by the Ramon Maharshal. As I mentioned in the L, it's like, again, classically, until pre-1500, most of the Torah was in Germany, and maybe Czechoslovakia. But things moved east to Poland, you know, Prague and Poland after that, and the Lavush is, you know, very representative of that. Being from Prague, learning by the Ramon Marshal, or Ramon Marshal, even though he's from Prague, and earlier Prague had been a self-center, and a main center of Torah, not that it was totally outside of everything now, but it's just not as central as earlier. He went, instead of Polish Jews going to Prague or Germany to learn, now it's like the shoes on the other foot, Kielu. And the Torah center has moved from Germany, Bohemia, on into Poland. He went back to Prague, which at this time, from this time on, was ruled by the Austrian Habsburgs. It's really, really interesting. I'll diverge. You know, part of history, people who enjoy history, who are definitely a minority of the world that I'm very aware of, don't mind divergences. So I'll diverge. A former student of mine, who I'm still actually quite in touch with, I get like really extensive emails telling me his latest, you know, theses, etc., etc., etc. We like to project backwards. I mean, I spoke about this L also, but he's trying to write a thesis about whatever, about how different countries reacted to the Black Plague, and for some reason he's assuming that England in the 1300s would be less religious than Italy. And I'm pretty sure that it's actually the opposite. In other words, even though today we view Catholic countries as being more religious and non-Catholic countries as being less religious, and it's true today, I agree with that. That is an accurate observation today. 700 years ago, that was not necessarily true, and maybe not true at all. So, okay, why am I going on to that historical divergence? Because the Habsburgs, even though at a certain later point in time, were very staunch defenders of Catholicism, but that's actually at a later point in time. Now, it is true that there were expulsions going on, and that's part of the Lavush's life, is he was expelled from Prague and went to Italy and lived around 10 years in Italy. But it was more the zeitgeist, as it would be said, properly, which is the spirit of the times, and the normative in Central and Western Europe in the 1500s was expulsions. Expulsions of Jews from city to city, from place to place, was very normal in the 1500s. In Europe, it was only, we'll see, it's going to take 2 or 3 weeks, we'll see what changed. Things changed after a very, key event in European history that really changed it. Which very, very fascinating, I found like a fascinating cover-up, Jewish cover-up of something that really happened. So, okay, anyway, he went on to Italy and then moved over to Poland, which again is like very typical because Poland, as again is said, Pauline, had his arms open to Jews. Jews were not expelled. I mean, there were cities they weren't allowed to live in. You ever went to Poland?
Mm-hmm.
So if you go, they'll tell you about that. But if not, I'll tell you about it probably. Jews were in Poland. There were certain cities they weren't allowed to live in, but by and large, they were welcome. Things were very smooth and peaceful in Poland.
Well, weren't they the like heads of commerce and stuff?
They were middlemen. They did the business. The Polish, you know, Szlachta, as it was called, owned land and fought wars. Similar to the Spanish gentry, the Spanish aristocracy, they thought that doing business was beneath them. It was not an honorable occupation for a businessman. So who did their business? The Jews. Who did their business? Okay. He was in Rabbanus in a number of places. is the rabbi of a number of places, which is actually, for the records, very typical, because according to my sources, I'm not sure exactly which later point in time, but unlike at a later point in time when Rabbanim were given more or less open-ended contracts, which after a certain point definitely did happen. In the 1500s and 1600s, Rabbanim were giving 3 to 5 year contracts. And if the community wasn't happy, or the rabbi wasn't happy, or whatever, then it wasn't, you know, like, it wasn't a life contract. Like, the truth today is that usually shul Rabbanim, synagogue rabbis, are also more or less, I mean, it's not always a life contract, but the ideal is that the rabbi is going to be the rabbi of the shul forever. Kilo. I mean, it's very hard. I mean, it's very traditionally difficult. If the shul's had a rabbi for 10, 20, 30, you know, usually when it breaks 20 to 40 years, whoever comes into his place is not simple at all. It takes a very accomplished rabbinical figure to replace a rabbi who was a rabbi so long. Okay. Fine. Okay, what's he best known for? He's best known for writing a sefer called the Levush. That's what it's called. It's Eser Levushim. Levushim means clothes. Literally. So Levushim means clothes. Okay. Now, he started writing it when he was young. I wasn't able to verify this fact, exactly how young and why he thinks that he started writing it so young. He started writing it young. I mean, it is definitely a known fact. Rilvush probably says this explicitly in his introduction, but I didn't have time to check his introduction. He was concerned that the Beis Yosef was too long. The Sefer Beis Yosef was too long, and your average person was not able to learn Beis Yosef. Beis Yosef is very lengthy. The tour is relatively short, but the tour was written in the early 1300s, and a lot happened after that. And the Beis Yosef went and tracked everything back to sources and brought other opinions, etc., etc., etc. The Beis Yosef was not written for the public at large. The Beis Yosef was written for scholars. That's what the Beis Yosef was written. It was not written for anyone else. It was written for scholars. So he started writing something shorter. Now, again, he was born in 1535, and Shulchan Aruch was printed in around 1570. So, as he was in the middle of his work, Beis Yosef came out and printed Shulchan Aruch. So he said, shucks. What am I going to do? And then he said, okay, you know what, wait a second, this isn't so terrible, because he only writes what Sfardim do. But he didn't write what Ashkenazim are going to do, so I still have what to do. So he kept on working out. Work on it more and maybe print it. But lo and behold, a year later, the Rama comes out and prints Haggah, prints Mappa. No one calls it Mappa. Only scholars call it Mappa. He prints his emendations, his Haggahs, on Shulchan Aruch. And so the Levush is actually a Talmud of the Rama. He was actually a Talmud of the Rama, even though he was not that much younger. The Rama is maybe 5 years older than the Levush. But still, he's a Talmud of the Rama. So he initially he said, "Okay, what am I going to do?" You know, it's like a very famous midrash says that Rabbi Kiva darshaned every S in Chumash, and then when he got to Es Hashem al Kachatira, he couldn't figure out what to do. S Hashem, your God, fear. What else could there be? You can't include anything on that. Fine. So he said, "Kashem shekibalti skara drisha, kach kabel skara prisha." Just like I got rewarded for saying it, so I'll get rewarded from now for saying they're all not true. Fine. So the Levush was a little not sure what to do, but then he analyzed the Shulchan Aruch and Ramah and said, "Okay, these guys did good work. The problem is, it's too short." It's too short. It's just Piskei Dinim. That's what it is. Shulchan Aruch is just Piskei Dinim. It's boop, 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 boop. I don't know, you've learned Mishnah Berurah. Yeah, I've learned Mishnah Berurah. No, a little bit. Okay. If you just have the Mechaber on top, Mechaber Rama on top, you don't have that much. They don't really explain much. They don't explain why. They don't explain what. They just say, this is Halacha. So that's difficult. For an average person, make another day to prayer. So I have an old friend, an old chavrusa, who teaches halacha in one or two different girls' schools. I actually saw him today. I can ask him which ones he's in right now. But he's in a couple. He at one point was in two. I'm not sure if he ever met and graduated to three. But he definitely was in two different schools. And there is a machlokas amongst people who teach girls halacha what they should do. Do you try to explain it somewhat to them, or you just make them do rote memorization? He believes in explaining it. Now he's a very yeshivishy guy. Don't think he's not a yeshivishy guy. He's a very, very yeshivishy guy. But there's a major question if a person should, if you're teaching girls or whatever, at beginning students, etc., should you engage in explanation or just force them into rote memorization? Because the facts are rote memorization is difficult. So if you give a guy a lot of facts without any explanation for it, most people can't remember it. Which is why most people have problems with history, because there just seems to be a lot of facts with no connection. And people's historical memory is so weak, they can't link everything together. And today there's short attention span, but even without it, it's been a fact for a long time that people think history is dead boring. Okay, anyway, so that's why the Levush wrote the Levush. Because he said, look, the Rabbi Rabbah, they're very great people, but there's a technical problem. The technical problem is they're trying to force people into rote memorization, and that's not going to work. People are not able to do that, and therefore I will write a sefer, which he called Levush. Each one of the different Chelkei Shulchan Aruch has a different name. Levush Ahog, Levush Adish, don't even ask me, I can't even, Levush Amalchus, Levush Adish, I don't remember. The one on Torah is called Levush Aura. Is one of them. There's one on Rashi called Levush Aura. On Chumash Rashi called Levush Aura. There's 10 Levush, I don't even remember all their names, whatever. He's just called the Levush. That's what he's called. Okay. Now, the facts are. Let me first explain something else. The Levush is a very interesting sefer. A very, very fascinating chibur, cheshev, fascinating piece of work. If you're learning halacha seriously, and you have no more time than many people would spend on it, if you want to do serious work, you want to understand why is the halacha like this. Many times, the only clear, explicit place you could find who would give an explanation is the Levush. He will come up with theories to explain things to no one else bothered explaining. The Rishonim apparently felt it was simple, did an explanation. There's no reason to theorize. And later Achronim sometimes like Levush, and sometimes literally want to throw him right out the window. That's what happens. Now, it's that people like to hear set pat rules in what they call how do we paskin? We paskin, Mr. Brewer over the Oral Kashrut. We paskin, Oral Kashrut. We paskin. Let me tell you something. There are not that many really clear set rules. There are. It's true, Ramesha Feinstein held, generally speaking, of the Hachra of the Oral Kashrut over the Mr. Brewer. He held the Aruch HaShulchan was a Rav, was in Rabbanus, was a Rabbi, and Mishnah Berurah wasn't. And he, generally speaking, gave certain, priority, he favored the Aruch HaShulchan a little over the Mishnah Berurah, but Rosh is a very litvish posek, and he really did, if he had a real opinion on it, so he literally did not care what anyone said for him, so he did it, you understand what I mean? He did care, but if he had a real opinion on the sugya, he didn't resort to what we call chalei psak. He had his opinion, and that was his opinion, and that's how he passed it. I can tell you, I'm talking now from first-hand experience, and having engaged in serious analysis of Igros Moshe. So anyway. I know people like to hear pat rules. We do this, we do that, this, that. But you have to give a different rule, which I don't know how much it'll mean, but I'll give it to you. I'll say it anyway. They say that in Lithuania, they pass from the Shach, And in Poland, they bask in like the Taz. I don't know.
What's the Taz?
We'll get to each of them later on. And let's say, I think we'll do them before we hit Shabtai Tzvi. So, okay, that's what they say. That's what they say. And as a matter of fact, I know is almost an absolute fact that Rabbi Soloveitchik, when he said Shiran Yerodea, he only said it with the Shabbos. He didn't bother saying the Taz because he was coming from Lithuania. So, there's certain truth to it, but that's also somewhat of an oversimplification, what you do with this. Okay, so, what I'll say, what I feel is a more, accurate statement, the more accurate statement is that the Lubavitch is definitely very important. He's a very important, integral part of the halachic process. The Shach, most specifically, is known for arguing with Lavush. It's a pastime of his to argue with Lavush. The Taz also likes to argue with Lavush, and one of his most comical statements on anti-Lavush statements is he attacks a certain Lavush, and he says, "I feel more of a chani, even the Bach, the Taz was the Bach's son-in-law." Says even my father-in-law got this one right. So, and that's like, but again, it's oversimplification. But to think that the Lavush is only there to be someone to argue with. He certainly made a very positive contribution. Now, in an interesting historical footnote, which I can't resist saying, we live in the era of last names. Okay? Today, everyone has a last name. It's not possible to have a person without a last name. Now, classically speaking, Ashkenazi Jews only picked up last names somewhere between 1760 and 1820, or 1825. That's when Ashkenazi Jews picked up last names.
Who gave it to them?
Who gave it to them? Now, it could be in Prussia, Jews who entered Prussia. Prussia was Brandenburg, Berlin area. Later, they ruled little pieces here and there throughout. They eventually conquered Silesia. Jews from Prussia probably picked up last names earlier, but there weren't that many Jews living in Prussia. They conquered, by God, what's up? Why did they pick up last names? That's getting too late modern, and maybe we'll touch on. We'll get there towards the end of the year. That's when the late Enlightenment and what's called the era of enlightened despots decided to quote utilize Jews more efficiently. And in order to have governmental records of somebody, you need a last name. So in Austria, for example, whoever was in Austrian ruled territory, which means Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Galicia, because in the late 1700s, Austria annexed large parts of Poland. These Jews got last names in the late 1700s, between 1760 and 1780. As a matter of fact, a guy I know, whose last name is Blech, you heard the last name Blech? Rabbi Blech? You know Rabbi Blech? You've heard of him. Okay, I know someone else's last name is Blech. And I don't know if maybe he's related to Rabbi Blech, maybe he's not related to Rabbi Blech. But not Mukach at all. It's impossible to know without checking it out carefully. Because the last name Blech means 10. T-I-N, 10. And according to his family legend, when they decreed Jews have to have last names, the more money you paid, the better last name you got. You paid more money, you got a last name like gold or silver or green or blue. Okay? So his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather didn't feel like paying too much money to the Austrians. Mm-hmm. So they gave him a very cheap last name, Blech. Okay, so that leads us on to the fact that the Lavush, whose name is given as Mordechai Yaffe, Jaffe, and the name of Mordechai Yaffe the last name Yaffe, Jaffe, is absolutely no. I didn't see any source to say that, and I hope next week we'll get to the first Horowitz we're going to mention, and we'll just wait till you get there, patience. I don't know. That might answer the question. You know what? That might answer it. Just what's his razor? Not that I know of. Not that I know of. It is a funny last name. It definitely is known. In other words, descendants of the Wavush call themselves Yaffe. Ada, you know, until this very day, I have an old friend whose last name is Mordechai Yaffe. Mordechai Jaffe. I think it's Jaffe, not Yaffe. But whatever. And he is descended Ben Acher Ben, son, you know, paternally from the Wavush. And many other Yaffas are the same. They say the same thing. So it's somewhat of a mystery why they're the exception to the rule. The exception, it's not the rule. The rule is Ashkenazi Jews do not take last names. And they were against taking last names. Jews from Poland and Russia did not like last names. And they played games with them. And in Galicia, they also apparently played games with them. They didn't like the last names. They felt they were imposed. They felt they were, you know, partially, there was anti-Semitic, you know, intent. And that's a fact. If he was Sephardi, then that would answer our question. We don't have proof. At the present moment, I didn't see proof that he's of Yotzei Sephardi descent. And again, Be'ez Rosh Hashem, next week, we'll have more to say about it. And not about Mordechai Yaffe, because now we're done with Mordechai Yaffe. Okay, let's go on. About the Wavush to someone who's called Rishua Falk. Okay, Rishua Falk, who's also last key, was sort of called Katz, but again, he wasn't really called Katz, because if you look, I'll tell you why we're going to talk about his name in a minute. We'll get there in a minute, in a couple of minutes. No one used last name, so it's true that he was a Kohen and did tack on the name Kohen Tzedek to the end of his name, but he didn't go by the last name Katz. He said, "Hey, Rabbi Katz, how you doing?" That wasn't done. So he was known as Rav Shua / Falk. Okay, he's best known for writing a sefer called the Prisha or the Drisha. And we'll get there in a minute. That's what he's really known for. He wrote something else also, but he's also well known from it, not quite as well. Okay, he died in around 1614, learned by the Ramah. And he lived in a city which used to be called Lemberg. Lemberg. It's not called Lemberg anymore.
Where?
Today it's in the Ukraine.
Kiev?
No, Kiev has always been. Today it's in the Ukraine. It used to be called Lemberg, then it was called Lvov. And now it is called Lviv. Which is ironic, in other words, the difference between Lvov and Lviv, which are very similar, as you can see, is the difference between Ukrainian and Russian. Ukrainians, whenever Russians say "ah," Ukrainians will say "e." "Ooh" or "ah," the lot of the Ukrainians will change it to an "e." So, hence, Lvov to Lviv. Now, what's ironic is most people who live in Lvov are Russians, not Ukrainians. So, they probably are thinking it's funny that it's called Lviv, not Lvov. I've never actually been there, so I can't tell you certainly. It was really very much part of Poland until modern days. Shalom.
Sorry I'm late.
The Rishua Falk is the beginning of a, not the beginning, but an early example of a known pattern. What's this known pattern? His father-in-law was a very wealthy man who lived in Lemberg / Lvov. And he married, his wife's name was Bela. Bela.
She's known.
You put him over wife. Yeah, his wife's name was Bela, and his wife is actually quoted here and there in halachic works.
Well, it's weird.
Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it? One of the other Gedolei Achronim bashes Bela for having the audacity to stick her head into halachic issues. Now, as long as we're going on historical side tangents, I'll go on a historical side tangent and tell you that Rabbi Soloveitchik's mother, Pesha, was a known genius. And they say, the family tradition says, that Reb Chaim said that Pesha is a bigger expert in Yoredeia than Velvel, than the Prisker Rav. Yeah, that's what they say. I don't know. That's what I heard from what I call very accurate sources.
Wow.
So, whatever. Okay, so this is like a very early example. Now, that's Rabbi Soloveitchik's mother's mother was the daughter of a rabbi. She wasn't the daughter of a businessman. Okay? I got that. We'll see, I think, next week, an example like that. Bela, the wife of the Jewish of Reb Shoval, was the daughter of a wealthy businessman. And in contrary to common belief, it's a very old Jewish practice to support sons-in-law. And this is one of the known examples. It's an old Jewish practice. It is very old. It predates modern Jewish politics.
Evidently,
I mean, you understand we're talking about the late 1500s, let's say we're talking about, I would guess, around 1560 or 1570. So that's over 400 years ago.
Yeah.
A couple of days ago, Hussein. And his father-in-law supported him very nicely. And as a result of that, instead of going becoming a classic, you see, there was no such thing as a synagogue rabbi. Synagogue rabbis, I'm not sure when they really start in a real way, but he was not, the classic rabbi back in Eastern Europe was the town rabbi. He's a rabbi of a town.
And there's one show in the town, right?
The Tibet happy that no.
All Jews. All Jews are small. At least two shuls.
You know that Jewish job, don't you? Well, you gotta have at least the shul you dominate and the shul you don't dominate. I mean, they're small, they would have one. But Lvov Lemberg was large with at least here. Bezer Shah, and you can go to Poland this year, you're not sure, you don't know.
Am I going to?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
You're not sure. So if you go to Krakow's pretty was a pretty big city, Jewish wise. Krakow, I right now, like, off, you know, I spit at you five shuls right now. I got like five shuls I get.
But there was still one rabbi, the main rabbi.
Oh, there was still the rabbi of the entire Krakow. I'm not sure if each of those shuls had their own rabbi. They didn't have their own rabbi. That's an interesting question. But anyway, as far as we're concerned, the shul was Rosh Hashiva, not a rabbi. I'm not sure if he's the first person in that situation or not. But that's what he was. His follow-up, you know, very generously supported him and allowed him to do that. Okay. Now, like this. Last year, toward the middle end of last year, like, you have to understand that in theory, all halacha has to be connected back to Shas. And for example, that's what's really authoritative. You know, when there were all the Shas burnings in the late 1100s, early 1200s, when the first ideas came up in the 1100s, the Jews went to the church and said, listen, this is our rule, you can't burn this book, this without this, we don't know what to do, this is it. This, as far as we're concerned, is basically, you can't burn this. This is what we live out of. Okay? So that's the theory. The Vilna Gaon, we've heard of the Vilna Gaon, of course? Mm-hmm. The Vilna Gaon, yeah. The Vilna Gaon, his quotes, Perush, Bir HaGra, on Shulchan Aruch, is just sourcing. I mean, it's a little more than sourcing. But the primary thrust of the Bir HaGra is sourcing. Where did he get it from? How does he understand the Sugi? And that's true. Let's go on a step. Now, Torah develops to a certain extent. The Rambam's Yad, Mishnah Torah, is like, it was meant to be sort of independent. Even though the Rambam really meant, as you may be aware, that everyone should just learn Mishneh Torah, it's hard to know if even amongst Sephardim, it ever was used practically. In other words, the way Shulchan Aruch was used. Was it ever practically used as you have, in other words, in Eastern Europe, in the different shuls, there was a Shir in Chaya Adam. Okay, in Lithuania and Belarus, in Lithuania and White Russia, when the rabbi sat down to give a shir, he gave a shir to the Baal Baklan, to the simple people who weren't so learned, he gave him a shir in Chaya Adam. Mr. Brewer is much later. Okay? In Hungary, but it was actually, this is one of those rules which isn't completely true. In Hungary, the rabbi gave a shir from Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. Okay, this is not completely true because Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is much more recent work. And they say, Jewish folklore says that when the Rav Shmuel Gansri, the author of Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, when he went to the Tanzer, he went to the Kreuzberger, the original Tanzer Rebbe, Chaim Tanz, he's 20 years of Talmud, he's a Chassidish Rebbe, he's also a very big Talmud Chacham. He went to him for a Haskalah, Chaim Tanzer said to him, no, Chaya Adam is Kitzur Shulchan, Mekatzur Shulchan Aruch. And that's short enough. Kitzur, your work? It's a Kitzur of Chaya Adam, a Kitzur of a Kitzur take a hike. No way, This is too short. Anyway. There is a concept of halachas svarim gaining their own independence and their own, being a source in and of themselves. That starts much more with the tour and even more afterwards. Master, I spoke about this more at length. There's late Ashkenazi works which can constitute a body of halacha, which once I get to a certain point in time, and we're right at the border of that right now. In other words, we're talking about the late 1500s, early 1600s. They're not going to, no one's going to say, you will see, no one will see next week, who didn't like this. But no one's going to say, someone can say, well, Shomar, Yosef Karo, Amar Rabbah, they're too close. They're not really authoritative. We don't have to worry about them. We can do it on our own. But no one's going to go past the tour. No one, even the quotes, until you get to the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon is very revolutionary. But until you get to the Vilna Gaon, no one's going to say, forget the tour. So you have, it has therefore arisen a practice. People can learn halacha seriously, and they will learn the sugya ki'ilu. Sometimes they won't even learn the sugya. I'm an old friend, he's the Rosh Kol somewhere, wherever in Eretz Yisrael. He's a very, very bright young man. He's not so young anymore, but he's a couple years older than me, so I'm not going to be young again either. So he doesn't even bother with the Sugya. He just went to tour Beis Yosef and straight to Shulchan Aruch, and he's, I don't know, I can't do it that way. I'm not a good faker. So, or I don't know, maybe he's smarter than me. This could be true too. But I can't do it that way. I can't. I mean, I at least have to see the Sugya in order to have a basic feeling of it. I mean, you can't, we're not, Ramosha, he had the whole thing, developed in his way. So it looks like he goes straight from the Sugya to Shulchan Aruch, but it's not really true. It's much more complicated than that. But the point for us is the tour in the Beis Yosef, and certainly these Kippurim, these other works from the late Rishonim, early Akronim, they gain a life in and of themselves and an importance in the halacha. That when you're studying halacha seriously, you're going to spend a serious amount of time on the tour and maybe not even look at the sugya, or just look at the sugya very quickly. So, because of that, Peshua Falk says the Beis Yosef is a great work. Now he's not trying to compete with the Beis Yosef like the Bavush. He's rather saying, if I want to learn the tour, the Beis Yosef doesn't really help me so much. The Beis Yosef brings the entire sugya, all the Rashis, all the Tosas. He doesn't bother explaining 70% of what the tour says. He assumes he figured it out already, and that's not good. That's A, B is he didn't like all the Beis Yosef's analysis,
So those are two problems, but that's very normal. You know, two Jews have used to be different opinions there. They're not, the disliking analysis is a separate, that's like you were very normal.
So he wrote two svarim, two works on tour. One is called Prisha, and one is called Trisha. Prisha, Kishmoke, both of them, Kishmoke, they are what they sound like they are. Prisha means explanation, like Mefaresh, and that's what he wrote, an explanation to the tour. So if you're just opening up a tour, you are not out of your depths. You're not lost. You are in the tour, and you'll be fine. Okay? That's one thing. Trisha is trying to explain the tour's approach in the sugya, and I wouldn't say, it's oversimplification to say he wrote it to argue with the Beis Yosef, because he doesn't always argue with the Beis Yosef, but he wrote it as a more lengthy commentary to explain the tour's approach to the sugya, which the Beis Yosef does do sometimes, but not all the time. Okay. Now, he wrote one other work. He wrote one other work. It's called Sma, Sefer Meir Seinai, the book that enlightens the eyes. The book that enlightens the eyes. And that is commentary on Kol Shel Mishpat. It's commentary on Kol Shel Mishpat. We know what Kol Shel Mishpat is? Shulchan Aruch. It's part of Tur and Shulchan Aruch. Because Tur and Shulchan Aruch have the same sections. Do we know which part of Shulchan Aruch it is? No, okay, it is legal law. Contracts, loans, stealing, damages, all those sorts of things.
Business,
yes, all those things. All those things are called, that's legal law. That's legal law. So that's the part Shulchan Aruch he wrote on. Sefer is called Sma. It's a standard, it's the earliest of the Mefarshim. So in other words, Shulchan Aruch was written in around 1570. 72, 73, something like that. 71, I have to back up and check everything out to tell you exactly. But that's what's written. The Sma cannot be, at most, was written 40 years after that. Which, in other words, is the earliest of all Mefar Perushim written on any of the Shulchan Aruch. Now, I'll tell you some blunt facts. I've learned a nice amount of Or Chaim and Yardaya. B'Iyun. I've learned a nice amount of it in a serious fashion. I've never really learned any of Kol Shel Mishpat in a really serious fashion. I mean, I've learned the sugyas in what I call a yeshivish approach. You know, I've learned Baba Kama, Baba Basra, Baba Kama, Baba Masiya, learned all those, I've learned those Masafas. But I wasn't learning them halacha. I mean, the only time I didn't do it. No, years ago, like 12 years ago, I learned Kurama Garmi for like 3 months. But that's not really, whatever, I didn't really, whatever. That's simple. I can tell you this story another time. If you really want to hear that story, I can tell you that story. That's like the most exposure I have to Kol Shel Mishpat, which means I don't have that much exposure to Kol Shel Mishpat. So unlike, you know, everything, when I say my impressions about a sefer, I usually say my own impressions. I'm not, you know, quoting, I'm not giving you second-hand opinions, I'm giving you first-hand opinions. So when it comes to giving you a sefer, about the Prisha and Drisha, I can tell you my opinion, because he wrote it on all the chalakim, all the sections of Tur. So I've learned Choshen Yerdeh and Choshen and Or Chaim. I mean, not all of them, seriously, but enough of it to have an opinion. Choshen Mishpat, I didn't. So I'm about exactly the style of the Sma in Choshen Mishpat. I can't really tell you much. It seems to be short a little bit, but besides that, I mean, that's just from like dabbling, as Rabbi David would call it. Can't really say much more than that. I mean, it's a good question if he's known more for Sma or for Trisha Prisha. I think he's known more for Trisha Prisha simply because Kol Shel Mishpat today is a very big specialty. In other words, even though in theory, in the theoretical world, as we say, you know, everyone should be learning Kol Shel Mishpat. Anyone who's in business should learn Kol Shel Mishpat, right? And Mr. Salantra always said, Balabatha, the people who are working, think that they only need to know Or Chaim and Yardaya. It's not true. They need to know Kol Shel Mishpat. It applies to them more than it applies to Rabbanim. Rabbanim rabbis are just, you know, the people who are working, they're supposed to know Kol Shel Mishpat. But again, the facts on the ground are, most people don't really learn that much about Kol Shel Mishpat for whatever reasons. I don't want to get into, we can culturally examine that later, maybe as we get on later, or maybe in a different year, different venue. But facts are, Chosh Mishra is a not that well worked section of Shulchan Aruch. So, I don't know. I think he's better known for Trisha. Fine, on come, guys.